Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of
mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Rebecca Lavoie, in for Virginia Prescott. Say the name Joyce Maynard in a crowd, and you're likely to get some pretty visceral and varied reactions. From those who've admired her career since her beginnings as a reporter for the New York Times and her later syndicated column Domestic Affairs, and from her detractors, those who are highly critical of her relentless self-examination and her revelations about her affair with J.D. Salinger. Salinger was living as a recluse in Cornish, New Hampshire, when he began exchanging letters with Maynard after reading an article she wrote for the Times as a freshman at Yale. She dropped out of college and moved in with Salinger, living with him for 10 months. She was 18, Salinger, 53. In 1992, Maynard was living in Keene, New Hampshire, when her novel To Die For became a breakout hit. The book was based on New Hampshire teacher Pam Smarts conspiring with her students to murder her husband. It was later made into a film starring Nicole Kidman.
The way I remember, it was your plan all along. You and Jimmy, you had this crazy fixation about me, and you were getting some kind of perverted kick out of the whole idea, like people with your sexual problems tend to do.
Joyce Maynard's latest fictional take on true crime is the novel After Her. It takes place in Northern California in the late 1970s, with two adolescent girls living in the shadow of Mount Tamalpais in Marin County. There, a serial killer is on the hunt, raping and strangling women hiking on the mountain trails. Here's Maynard reading from the prologue of After Her, which speaks to the innocence of the girls and the dark things that are about to change their lives forever.
Nothing much ever happened on the mountain where we lived growing up. We were always hoping for a little excitement. So my sister and I made up situations. All we had was time. One day, we decided to see what it felt like to be dead. I had a red sweatshirt, the kind with a zipper up the front, and a hood and pockets to keep gum. I spread it out on a patch of grass on the hillside behind our house, with the sleeves stretched out as if they were a person who'd been run over by a truck, the hood off in a different direction, so as much of the red part showed as possible, like a pool of blood. "Lie there," I told my sister, pointing to a spot in the middle over the zipper part. She might disagree, but Patty nearly always did what I told her. If she had questions, she kept them to herself.
That was Joyce Maynard reading from her novel After Her. Joyce Maynard, welcome to Word of Mouth and welcome back to New Hampshire.
Oh, I love being in New Hampshire, Rebecca.
Mount Tamalpais, a real place where you lived for a long time after you left New Hampshire. Can you describe it and what drew you there?
Well, I spent the first 42 years of my life in the state of New Hampshire and decided when my kids got older to broaden our horizons. And I went as far west as I could, which was the Bay Area of California. And I drove over the Golden Gate Bridge and saw this mountain. It's, to people who know the White Mountains or certainly the Sierras, it's not a particularly distinctive one, but it rises out of nowhere. And I was just drawn to take that exit. In my odd way, I went to a real estate open house the next day on that mountain, because it was on that mountain, and bought the house that I visited. And it was a kind of a crazy thing to do. I've done a few of those, I guess, in my life. And I have lived there for 17 years, and it's on that mountain that I wrote this book. And every morning of my life living in that house, I would look out at this big black rock, basically, facing me like a freight train coming closer. But it wasn't for some time before I learned the history of one particular event that had taken place there, or a series of them.
After Her, it's based on true events. David Carpenter, known as the Trailside Killer, he raped and murdered at least five people on the trails around the very mountain where you moved. Talk about how you became interested in the case. How did you hear about it?
Well, everybody who lives out there is aware of that case. It took place in 1979 to 1981, but people who lived there then will still bring it up. But it didn't become personalized to me until I host writing workshops at my home, and two women now in their 40s showed up for a one-day class in memoir, which is what I love to teach. And it turned out that they were the daughters of the homicide detective who had been in charge of that investigation. And they were still, over 30 years later, very haunted and shaped by the experience of growing up in the shadow of those killings, and in particular, what those killings had done to their father. It was one particular thing that the older of the two sisters, Laura, said to me that really made me sort of made my alarm bells go off. She said that she had just recently, within the last few years, she had written a letter to the Trailside Killer, who's still on death row in San Quentin, to ask to come and see him. And she went to see him. Their father had died shortly after the arrest of the killer, and he had never confessed, and she really believed that it was these killings, this series of murders, that had destroyed her father. And she wanted to look him in the eye and see if she could find any resolution. She didn't.
Well, you fictionalized the story. This isn't the first time you've done that. To Die For was a breakout hit for you based on the Pam Smart case. Many of the details of the actual crimes you write about, the real life crimes, do end up in the fictionalized version, but the fictional part, the part that you bring to it, is usually a lot closer to home. What kinds of stories do you like exploring when you look at these crimes?
You know, I hardly even know anymore what really happened, because after you work on a novel for a few years, you know, the facts of the real case and the story you create kind of blur. It isn't so much that the story reveals to me, oh, that would be interesting, as that story seemed to touch on themes and obsessions that have been with me always. At the core, one of them certainly is adolescence, and the adolescence, the vulnerability of a young girl in particular. And we hear a lot about young boy coming of age adventures, but I was really moved by the picture of two girls who are very much sort of raising each other. Their parents have divorced, their mother's kind of checked out, their father is consumed by this case, and although they adore him, he's a very flawed and deficient father. So they're sort of left to their own devices. And they decide that they are going to, or the older sister decides, with the magical thinking of a 13-year-old, that she is going to help her father solve this case. She sees the case destroying him, and she sets herself up to be bait for the killer. It is a drama constructed by a 13-year-old girl with all of the magical thinking and craziness of somebody who, you know, who uses a Ouija board.
One of my favorite parts of the book is when you write about sort of the human condition of a 13-year-old girl. I'm hoping you can read a bit of that.
Sure. 13-year-old girls live in two different worlds. They exist like citizens of two distinct countries. And though these two places are as different as Croatia is from New Guinea or Mercury from Saturn, they float between the two as effortlessly as a person might from one side of the Golden Gate Bridge to the other. Partly, a 13-year-old girl is still a child, capable of finding joy in setting grass on fire in a tin can, or thrill in the sight of a neighbor answering the ring of the doorbell and opening the door to discover no one there, only a rustle in the bushes. 13-year-old girls can actually believe that the reason they won't get to marry John Travolta is because he's got a girlfriend already, and that Peter Frampton's getting a haircut qualifies as a tragedy, and that receiving a call from a particular boy, or a particular girl, for that matter, is the most wonderful thing that ever happened. 13-year-old girls believe in heroic fathers and wicked stepmothers. They believe the words to songs and the advice of other 13-year-old girls, and that the first boy they love, they will love forever.
That's Joyce Maynard reading from her novel After Her. It's a book based on a series of real-life killings committed in the late 1970s in Marin County, California. That excerpt was describing the mindset of the narrator, a 13-year-old named Rachel who tries to set a trap to catch the killer in order to help her dad, who's a homicide detective. Joyce, 13, what is it about that age that so fascinates you?
It's so vulnerable. It's just such a tender, poignant time for me, because a young girl at that age, and I remember this from my own age 13 and from my daughter's, is right in the middle of, there's a big part of her that's still a child. I still had Barbies when I was 13, but she's also now, more even than in 1979 where my novel was set, she's also thrust into the world of adult sexuality. And this was heightened by the experience of these particular girls, because there is this very dark and twisted sexual landscape that is right behind their house, and there is, you know, something that could be sort of beautiful and tender is very ugly and scary.
The novel also explores themes of sisterhood, the relationships between parents and children, and divorce. You've written quite a bit about your own divorce over the years, and then I think in this book in particular, the thing that struck me, I recently listened to an episode of The Moth that you recorded several years ago where you talked about trying to create a sort of perfection for your kids in the wake of divorce. And it plays out very differently here. As you mentioned, the mom is checked out. The dad is, you know, kind of a mess, really wrapped up in this case. knowing that that perfection doesn't work, is this your way of sort of playing out different scenarios?
Absolutely. You got it. I mean, it's one of the haunting, you know, the themes that has just, you know, obsessed me over the years, the desire to create this happy family. I came from a really interesting, inspiring family. I loved both my parents deeply, but I idealized those families, those perfect-looking families on television, and I wanted to be part of one of those. And these girls, actually, there's a scene early on in the book when they're looking at the Brady Bunch, also through a TV window. Their family is so broke, they don't have cable anymore, they don't get TV, but they look through the picture window of their neighbors and watch the Brady Bunch and wish that that was them. And of course, what I know now, and it took me way too many decades to figure this out, is that it's a lie, that perfect family. The reality is that all of our lives are, we're all stumbling along trying to figure it out the best we can, and I'm much kinder and gentler on myself, I think. But in my days as a young single mother in my 30s and early 40s when my kids were growing up, I desperately felt a desire to sort of make it match other people's families and make it save them pain. Now I'd say that it's pain that contributes to our compassion and strength. And there's no protecting children from that. All you can do is make them strong enough to handle it.
You are one of those writers that people have often talked about and written about, but a lot of the conversation isn't about your writing. It's about Joyce Maynard, the person. Would you flip that if you could?
Well, you know, and I have to say I brought that a lot of that on myself because I write about myself. And I don't do it because I regard myself as the most fascinating character around. But I'm the character that I know best. I'm the only one that I really have any business talking about in quite such an intimate way. And I have to say I don't find it a problem doing that. I grew up in, I mentioned, an alcoholic family where we didn't talk about what was going on. So I have this deep commitment to talking about the truth, just saying it, naming it. It's always, what's the worst that can happen? If you talk about what's really happening, it's my experience, you know, if children are afraid of a monster under the bed, the best thing to do is look under the bed, turn on the lights and look under the bed. But I've written some pretty self-revealing essays and a memoir that certainly, you know, a lot of people criticize me for. The one single word that has most consistently been used is, and it's so interesting to me that this would be the word, is shameless. And I'd say, yeah, I that's what I'd wish for my children. Let them be shameless, unless there's something that they've done that they should be ashamed of. I hope that writing the way I do allows other people, especially women, to forgive themselves, their flaws. If I talk about mine, they're suddenly not alone anymore. I felt very alone growing up.
I'm wondering if the advice you would give to women writers who aspire to follow in your footsteps, is it accept that kind of criticism and scrutiny or rail against it?
You
what
know,
would you suggest?
I learned a powerful lesson. I used to try to please. I used to really look for my sense of who I was by what the world told me. And I was a good girl for a lot of years. When I published At Home in the World, the memoir that brought a shower of, not even criticism, condemnation down on me, it was hard to find a critic who said anything good about me. And it wasn't even the book. It was me, very personally. What I feel now is I am not going to take my sense of identity from what somebody else tells me about myself. I know who I am, and neither will I if somebody says I've, you know, written the most brilliant book ever. I hope I won't be pulled in that direction either. I know what I am and what I am not. I wrote an essay that was published a couple of days ago in the Wall Street Journal. It was about the story that I told was how when my marriage was falling apart and I was looking for some comfort somewhere, and I used to do this odd thing. If I would go to little towns in New Hampshire and I would go look at, I'd go to a real estate open house or even, you know, ask a realtor to show me some house. I was not buying a house. I didn't have the money to buy a house. But I would walk through these houses and just sort of imagine a different life. And I published this piece that was about that and about some other things. And I got this, I've been criticized for a lot of different things, but this was a new one. This angry man writing to say to me, you are exploiting real estate agents. So, you know, you can't win. Is that going to ruin my day? I'll live with that one.
Joyce Maynard, thank you so much.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Shadows go so long before my eyes.
Joyce Maynard's new novel is After Her. We've posted links to reviews of the book and some of her recent columns about Mount Tamalpais and adventures in real estate at wordofmouthradio.org. Maynard's memoir, At Home in the World, is being re-released this fall. There's also a new book and documentary on Salinger coming out next month. I asked Joyce if she was interviewed for the top secret film. She was. And I also asked how she feels about her Salinger revelations leaving an indelible mark on her career. You can listen to that part of our conversation by going to our Facebook page, Word of Mouth Radio. There's more Word of Mouth coming your way in just a minute.